Welcome to today's episode of Thriving in the Age of Disruption with Dr. Ramesh Ramachandra and Ms. Christy Davis. Ms. Davis has 3 decades of Asia experience across the private, public, and social sectors, and was Executive Director of Lian Center for Social Innovation at the Singapore Management University until August 2021. She's currently on sabbatical and continues to serve on the board of Transformational Business Network Asia. Ms. Davis is an American, but has made her home across 4 countries in Asia Pacific for more than 30 years, starting in Japan and working her way down to Singapore. She has jumped from corporate to humanitarian work with the UNDP immediately following the 2004 Asian tsunami as a private sector partnership advisor based in Bangkok. We're so happy you've joined us to hear Ms. Davis's story today, to explore how entrepreneurship in a corporate setting or intrapreneurship works, with the launch of a social enterprise supported by the organization that Ms. Davis was working for, and the challenges and struggles of managing a social enterprise, especially in terms of funding and long-term viability. We'll also learn how Ms. Davis has built resilience early in life, which has supported her in transitioning from being a successful woman leader in corporate to humanitarian work, to founding a social enterprise, and now to managing the big reset of uprooting her whole life after 30 years in Asia to return to the US to look after her elderly mother.
Welcome, Christy. Thank you for agreeing to be a Changemaker guest speaker in our Thriving in the Age of Disruption podcast series. We are delighted to have you today. And could you please tell us a little bit about yourself for starters?
My name is Christy Davis. I am originally from the U.S. and actually as of about 2 months ago, I'm back in the U.S., which is quite an unexpected adventure. I spent more than 30 years in Asia. So years ago, I got my undergrad degree in international relations in Japan Regional Studies at the University of Washington in Seattle, and did 2 years of that of my undergrad in Tokyo. And after graduating, I immediately went back to Japan and got a job with the Japanese government for 3 years. And from that point forward, have spent very little time living in the U.S., actually just one stint in Los Angeles after getting married. So Asia has been my home for my basically most of my adult life. And it's still where I would say I feel most comfortable. I'm married to a musician. I love music. So I really relish the fact that I'm surrounded by music most days, most of the time. Love to read. I'm a voracious reader. And just the last couple of years, I've started to really give myself permission to read fiction, historical fiction. I mean, I always have a heavyweight book on my nightstand, but I've really enjoyed, I read for pleasure. So I just read novels and fiction that I find as a wonderful de-stressor. I don't watch a lot of TV to do that, though I do have my Netflix, periods. Let's see, what else do I do? I love to walk. I love just to be outside. I love to hang out with my girlfriends. I'm really fortunate. I've been married to a great guy for 23 years, but I'm a girl's girl. And there's not many things that I find greater pleasure in than hanging with my girlfriends over a cup of coffee or a glass of wine and talking for hours about all kinds of things. So fellowship with friends and family, girlfriends, good walks, sun on my face. Those are all things that I really, really take great pleasure in.
Christy, I wanted to explore a little bit about being an entrepreneur in terms of being someone who sets up and runs their own business or who is entrepreneurial at the workplace, and people commonly refer to that as an intrapreneur, or even someone who runs a social enterprise, which is essentially running a business, but with an impact or a kind of a bigger purpose. What I think is common in all these 3 descriptors is that they all point to a special kind of mindset. And I like to call this mindset the entrepreneurial or an entrepreneurship mindset.
have a corporate background, and that was kind of a traditional learning. You know, it was kind of, you know, cut my teeth on working for a large multinational in a regional role. And then I left that and went after the Asian tsunami in 1994 and went to work for UNDP. And that introduced me to the whole world of development and the humanitarian space. Loved it, fell in love with that. From there, then I did set up my own consultancy for about 7-8 years. And so it's interesting, if I think about, I would have never described myself as an entrepreneur or having an entrepreneurial mindset. But if I look back on my life, it's been nothing but risk-taking. And partly that's just the way I was raised. We moved all the time. I was always having to, you know, start fresh in a new city somewhere, get a new job, start a new school, meet, you know, new people, all of the things that one has to do to get to know other people, to get to know a new space, a new environment, and settle in.
That's really an interesting point that you have raised, Christy. Risk-taking is usually the hardest part of an entrepreneurial activity or entrepreneurship, as we have to take risk in making decisions and taking actions and making the end outcome more certain because it is actually uncertain. Now, nobody likes uncertainty. So it's clear, Christy, that you have developed a really powerful relationship to taking risk. And this was developed very early in life, like you shared, whether it was from moving to a new city, getting a new job, starting a new school. And it's a kind of resilience that you have been building up because it's allowed you to adapt well to uncertainty or to change in the kind of work that you ended up doing.
I went to work for a large NGO and worked there in disaster management for several years, and then had the opportunity to set up basically what was a startup inspired, a social enterprise inspired kind of startup within the organization called Asia P3 Hub. P3 meaning people, public, private. And we weren't we were not a profit making startup in that our whole purpose was to broker and facilitate multi-sector partnerships that could tackle issues of poverty and create positive social impact. So we wanted to kind of prove the hypothesis that in many circumstances, multi-sector partnerships were the answer, made sense to tackle that complex issue.
And that's another interesting aspect of entrepreneurs looking to solve some real world problem. And in your case, Christy, you wanted to prove your hypothesis of multi-sector partnerships being an answer to tackle poverty and create positive social impact. So did you get that project funded?
I wrote a proposal, got some funding, external funding. And then my NGO, they said, if you can go out and get some funding, we'll match it, which they did. And that was my executive sponsor who basically made the commitment that the office in Singapore, you know, and the organization would match it. We had 3 years basically to work toward proving that hypothesis. So hired a team, thankfully hired a team of people who knew what they were doing. And so they came around as I just had this grand idea, but didn't really actually in hindsight, really know how to kind of operationalize it. And thankfully I had people that were great at that. So we built a partnership hub. We built kind of a social enterprise, and we built from scratch. We branded separately. We leveraged the mothership, as we like to affectionately call it, which had depth and breadth across Asia Pacific. So we felt like it was a win-win. You know, we were this kind of pilot boat that was tossed off the ship. You know, the mothership, the big ship. And could scout new opportunities and then bring those back to the mothership, you know, and leveraging the depth and the strength and the experience and the relationships of decades in the region. But my executive sponsor within a year got promoted to a very senior role and, you know, moved to Europe, and he was gone. And I didn't realize at the time how critically important he was to our success. because the succession, you know, my what happened after that didn't quite have the we had to keep explaining ourselves over and over again. And we realized we did look different. We sounded different. We were leveraging the core values and skills and strengths and offerings, but I wasn't successful enough at really being able to convince those that had been in the, you know, in that core business for many, many years that we were worth that value to the organization. Even with great success, we brokered more than 25 partnerships in our 3 years, starting from scratch. I think we could have gone on to do more amazing things. But I think I learned that in spite of being, you know, bold and tenacious and creative and putting new ideas out there and just being darn excited about what we were doing and the opportunities that we felt that we were finding and discovering and bringing back to the organization, somehow, in spite of all of that, you know, it just didn't quite take. If I look back on what did I learn from that and why didn't any, we spun off eventually then. I think the key is that internal, you've got to have that internal executive sponsor and someone with a heavyweight internally that definitely has your back and understands enough that they will go and fight for you. And that was a massive learning for me. I felt very, you know, in hindsight, I think, oh, for heaven's sakes, I was so naive. You know, you read all the books out there. I'd read the Lean In books and, you know, and the Lean Startup books and all of that. And still, in spite of kind of employing an entrepreneurial mindset, you know, leveraging my skills and my networks and all of that, was not sufficiently successful to translate that into the intrapreneurial
success
that I had hoped for. Yeah.
You know, Christy, it's an interesting reflection, but I want to challenge you to consider that as an intrapreneur, actually, you've been successful. Because where you've been stopped is in the mothership's corporate culture, being able to embrace this change. And it's interesting because when you look at all these large organizations who want to transform and who want to bring in a new culture for innovation and acceptance of new ideas, sometimes the easiest way for them is to spin off or to work with a small offshoot, right? Yeah. Away from the mothership.
Right. Yeah.
But then the dilemma and the creative tension always is to accept back that little idea. Yeah. So perhaps, you know, if I can offer you something is to maybe consider that it was not just your failure to get the organization to buy in. It was more that it was not the right time for the organization to buy in because their culture had not, you know, become at the same tipping point that your executive sponsor had when he approved the project.
Yeah, actually, that's actually really kind of you. And that actually, that's really nice. You know, I think my hope is that you're exactly right. I think, if you start to look at large organizations that have squelched, you know, some kind of an innovative, I mean, the big example is Kodak, you know, who I think basically it was one of their guys that invented the digital camera and look what happened there, digital technology. So you're right. It's really hard for these really well-established, large, you know, organizations to create the space and systems. I mean, part of it is systems are entrenched and they are not designed for, you know, kind of entrepreneurial, innovative offshoots, you know. So that's, we also found that the policies and procedures actually did not actually support our success. They may have supported the success of the organization of such a size. But so I think that's in hindsight, I hope that enough of what we did that there's that it inspired others. And you hope that, you know, whatever it looks like internally now, that there's still, you know, that there's, yeah, I hope that there's bits and pieces still kind of being that they're running with those internally. But if not, we did spin off. And I know that the organizations and the people that we did work with for that period of time, that lots and lots of people's lives were positively impacted. And that actually makes me feel great. Yeah, makes awesome. It was very, very worthwhile. An amazing learning experience. So no regrets. A few tears along the way, but certainly no regrets.
Yeah, that's the right spirit indeed. So after you spun off that social enterprise, you joined the Singapore Management University's Lien Center for Social Innovation, right? Was that similar to the previous NGO?
Oh, no, actually very different. SMU, in a sense, it's a mothership in a sense. But what was marvelous was to work for 2 years, you know, with the Lien Center for Social Innovation. So it's a small, innovative center. But we were focused on social innovation, which, of course, leveraged, you know, my background in the development and humanitarian work, but and partnerships, of course. So I would say it didn't feel like an NGO. For me, it was definitely a fresh experience to work for an academic institution. So there was always that rigor of the mothership, you know, is looking for that academic rigor. So everything we looked at needed to be evidence-based. So evidence-based insights that could then be transformed into practical actions, you know, put in the hands of practitioners that could do something to add their value and do something that would create positive social change. So it was an amazing 2 years. I learned so much working in a new, you know, environment like that, met amazing people, really, really enjoyed the work tremendously. But I would say it had a very, very different vibe than an NGO. So that was quite exciting. So I got to do the corporate thing. I did the UN thing, did an NGO thing. And then I got to spend a couple of years working for a university. So, you know, gosh, you know, pretty exciting. I've been very fortunate.
Yeah. So, you know, from that entire spectrum of working in an NGO, working for the United Nations, working in a university or running your own social enterprise, I guess you've had the opportunity to look at different business models. So what do you think are some of the new and emerging trends and collaboration models that people could use?
I don't know if it's new anymore, but we talk about it. It seems to just be such a challenge for everyone that it sounds like it's new. And that is, it is multi-sector, tri-sector collaboration and cooperation. So, I mean, it's not new in the sense that there's evidence of it. We've been talking about the public, private, and social sectors, you know, pooling their resources, collaborating with putting their unique value propositions together and pooling those so the solution for whatever it is that they're partnering for can be created. The sum is greater. What is it? The expression?
The whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Oh my gosh. You know, I just look at COP26 that's just finished, you know, in Glasgow, and I'm excited to do so to see, okay, there's nothing but tri-sector opportunities coming out of that because it's such a complex issue now. There is no way that it's not just government's problem or the private mm-hmm. sector's problem or, you know, civil society's issue. You know, we have got to figure out how we can pool our resources together to tackle, you know, those seemingly intractable wicked issues and causes of climate change.
Yes, definitely. You know, interestingly, with the work that we do with family businesses, in facilitating the next gen, co-creating their transgenerational legacy, we've actually seen a new kind of direction. And this is in regard to how the next gen consider their participation and contribution with the world at large. For instance, with our current clients in Hanoi, Vietnam, the Nguyen family, when we created a 30-year future with them, they created and committed to a transgenerational legacy which is founded on the three P's. And interestingly, Christy, the three P's that they are referring to include number one, planet renewal, number two, people development, and number three,
prosperity sharing. And to get this future, you know, to make this real, they would have to explore multi-sector partnerships and alliances at both micro and macro levels. I think it's really exciting because more family businesses can pivot using this 3P approach to build their own transgenerational legacy. And it's also impactful because if you think about this, family businesses are the biggest contributors to economic growth and wealth creation across the world. So in other words, what we are doing here is that we're switching the paradigm and the thinking that, you know, if society is flourishing, then that's going to be the most real evidence that a family is flourishing and so is their future. So can you imagine how we can accelerate dealing with these issues that you mentioned, whether it be elevate poverty or impact climate change and other societal concerns, if we can also now include family businesses, family enterprises, and their family offices.
I want to circle back to that conversation about being an entrepreneur and specifically ask you, what was that one thing that helped you to succeed? And, you know, that thing that you would recommend to our audience here?
I would say a big lesson learned, actually that I'm still learning, is just don't try to do everything yourself. I think there's a danger for entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs to be, an organization to be personality driven. I mean, if we think about, you know, entrepreneurs, obviously, you know, the Elon Musks, you know, or even the Steve Jobs, you know, come to mind, you know, Elon Musk. If Elon Musk is not at the head of Tesla and his other companies, would they thrive and survive and thrive? I'm not sure because he's such a huge personality. So I think that's one of the dangers of a dynamic, amazing visionary leader is, can they surround themselves and empower their team to a point where if they go away, that the organization can continue to flourish. I think to me, that is whether or not a leader is a true successful leader. To me, that's kind of the proof in the pudding. If they can step away and it can continue to thrive, don't try to do everything yourself. Surround yourself with people that have skills different than you. I think diversity is so important. I mean, you don't want to look like, you don't want your team to look like you and vice versa. And that way, then if I got, you know, if any of us get hit by a truck tomorrow, God forbid, the organization can continue, to move on and flourish. I think that's really important. Just to sum it up, don't try to do everything yourself and make sure that the love is spread around, to those, that you value and that you are giving, the authority and the responsibility to also help the organization be successful.
Well, that's great. You know, you've called out three things here, and that is namely, number one, empower the team to make the decisions and don't have them become too dependent on you as the entrepreneur leader. Two is appreciate the diversity of the team and its varied strengths. And number three, as an entrepreneur / founder, don't try to control everything. Great advice.
Right. And I think they should be pushed down as far as they can be responsibly pushed down, and be as flat as you can. You'll be more nimble. If I had to do the approval, then things get, slowed down because I would hold things up. Right. No, push it down, empower people, and then trust them. Trust them to make the decision. And if there's a mistake, you learn from it and you move forward. Keys is obviously to learn from it and not make it again and again. So absolutely.
Now, what struck me was that you're very skilled in working with a very diverse team of people, especially people across all age groups. How did you do that?
I think I've become a real believer in intergenerational teams. And I think now me as a middle-aged person, having friends and colleagues in their 20s, you know, and 30s and 40s. And then I have mentors and worked with people that are in their 70s. You know, I mean, it's, it's just this amazing range of ages. And there, oh my gosh, there's just, there's so much to learn from one another. And I just, I love the energy and the ideas of my younger colleagues. I remember at SMU, at Lehan Center, you know, some of my colleagues were late 20s, you know, maybe 30, and they would come up with things, ideas, or they have networks, or they had ideas for whether it was a project or a resource, or that I would not even on my radar. You know, like BTS, we did a lot of work around this idea of what BTS, the boy band out of Korea, is doing. And oh my gosh, it was amazing what we learned and what an example of social innovation they are. So I think part of it's giving all of your colleagues the space to put their ideas and on the table, so that they know that they're valued. Their thoughts, their ideas, the ways they work are valued, and that there's space for that. And that's tough sometimes, because I'm corporately, my formative years, my 20s and 30s were in an American multinational. You know, there's a very specific way of working, and there's a pecking order to things, and there's protocols, whether they're written or unwritten. So I still carry that baggage in a sense with me. And so sometimes the way my younger, even younger than what's before millennials, Gen X, Gen Z, I'm losing track, but the youngsters, I call them the youngsters affectionately, they work very differently. What they wear, the way they talk, and they don't, for me, it would be disrespectful to address people sometimes the way they do. And yet it's the way they write emails, you know, and oh my goodness. And, but just to give space for that, and to, instead of jumping in with a judgment or a comment, just keep my mouth closed and allow the space.
I like to explore this idea of giving space. What do you mean by that?
So I think that's one, is to, regardless of the kind of colleague or employee that you have, give them space to be who they are and value, show that you value who they are and the way that they contribute, that it may look very different than what you're used to. So that's one. I think the other is make sure we hear them, ask what they think. And I'm very consensus driven. My formative years, again, were in Japan. So I operate in a very Japanese style, which can be difficult sometimes when people expect, they just say, just tell us what to do. And lots of times, you know, I would actually be, let me gather the ideas from everyone, then we package it together. And then we put forward the approach moving forward. That was not always probably the best way when people wanted to be told what to do. But on the other hand, I really, really value the different ideas and perspectives that everyone has. I think the third thing to keep people motivated is just to have fun. But so just space for fun, creative ways to enjoy one another's company. Food is always a good one.
Yes.
So those are some of the obvious ones. Just bring food in and that kind of thing, and share your cultures if you're working in a multicultural environment. But I think the biggest thing, coming back to it seriously, is just understand what motivates them and how they feel valued, and then make sure that you create the space and the time to show that you do value them.
Christy, let me recap what you've shared about working with a diverse team of people. So one is, value the diversity of the intergenerational team by appreciating their energy or their ideas or the networks that they bring. Two, to give people space to be who they are, and more importantly, for them to feel safe to be able to share their unique ideas. Three, which I thought was really interesting, was to use consensus building as a way to bring people together so that they can share their different ideas and perspectives. And now, of course, number four, make it all fun for everyone.
So let me ask you a related question. How would you find the right people to partner with or collaborate with?
I would say there's kind of two key things that I look for. One is if there's a misalignment of values. I've learned this the hard way over and over, where someone, I hire someone, or someone's on the team, or perhaps it's a peer, or I mean, a colleague or a partner, and the skills perhaps are there, the intention, what we want to achieve together is there, the talent is there, but the values are not there. And if there's a misalignment of values, it doesn't matter how skilled or smart or well-connected that individual is, it will rupture. And I have, unfortunately, I've definitely learned that. I mean, I've had friendships that have actually been broken. I've had relationships that have been broken irretrievably, I think, because there was a conflict of values, a misalignment of values. And so I'm not saying mine were better than theirs, but they weren't aligned. I think the second kind of red light would be if that individual is not kind.
Well, that's interesting. Could you say a little bit more about not being kind?
How does that individual talk about others, treat people that you see? And see, there's, I remember decades ago, there was, I don't know if it's, this still happens anymore in interviews, but if someone was getting to like a final stage of an interview, the boss, the hiring manager would take that individual out for lunch or dinner or something like that and breakfast. But it was also to see how that person interacted with the waiter, the wait staff. Were they polite? Did they say please and thank you? Were they respectful? I don't know if that happens anymore, but it certainly happened in my multinational days. There would be opportunities. They would plant opportunities to create opportunities, rather, to see how that individual would treat other people. And so I think I had some opportunities to work with some amazing people, talented, well-connected, skilled, you know, all of those things on paper that you want. But they weren't kind. Mm. They weren't kind, or they talked poorly about other people. And so I thought, well, if they're doing that to them, how are they talking about me? So those would be the two things that I would look for, misalignment of values and a lack of kindness. And I've learned the hard way on both accounts that it just doesn't work. Mm.
Christy, if it isn't too personal, we'd like to hear a little bit more about that move that your husband and you had made back to the U.S. in August of 2021.
And so I was raised, as you know, by a single mom. And so she has, and she was diagnosed with dementia about 2.5 years ago. And that was quite traumatic at the time, because my mom and I were best buddies. You know, we traveled together. We were very, very close. And my mom lived in the same city as my brother, where the grandchild is. And he's done a great job looking out for her. She's lived on her own. But, you know, she wasn't really taking very good care of herself anymore. And she wasn't able to. We had a plan. We thought, oh, we'll be in Singapore. We've been there for almost, 14 years, 13 and a half years. We'll do another year and a half at least. And once the borders open up, we'll go back and forth more often. You know, we had this whole plan. And at about April, it was just kind of like, it was just like this moment of, what are we doing? And I don't know that there was a light bulb that went off that was like, there wasn't a single crisis, but it was a couple of conversations with our siblings that made it very clear that we were really, really needed. And actually, mm-hmm. we were, it was overdue. But no one on this side, no one on the US side was going to say that to us, because we've been in Asia forever. So all they, you know, people only knew of us, our families and friends only knew of us as living in Asia. I knew it was the right thing. And that was confirmed when a week after I got, I saw my mom, when I got back, she had a heart attack. And that exacerbated her dementia, and she could no longer live by herself. So within the space of weeks, I moved in with her, took care of her, and we had, the whole world is turned upside down. It's easy now to see, it's a darn good thing that I'm here.
Wow, I didn't realize that you were going through so much, you know, when you were making the move back to the US, but I am so glad that you made it back in time. Hey, please give your mom a big hug for me. Christy, I'm going to wrap up our discussion here. Thank you. Thank you so much for your candid and generous sharing about your life journey. And, you know, we're going to hear back more from you later on in a couple of weeks. But until then, see you, friend.
Thank you indeed, Dr. Ramesh and Ms. Davis. And to connect again, we certainly will. With International Women's Day coming up on March 8th, we'll hear more from Ms. Davis, who will share her experience and advice on how to succeed as a woman in management and leadership structures. We'd also love to hear from you, listeners out there, especially those of you who are young and ambitious to climb up the corporate ladder, or if you're someone who's already midway up, keen to grow into those top-level management positions. You know, from your own experience, tell us what you've done or learned to create your own support structure and success to getting higher up at work. Do email your thoughts to dr.ramesh@talentleadershipcrucible.com. You may click on the email given in the podcast description. And thank you once again for joining us today. Until we connect again in our next episode, be nice, have fun,